I think we're heading towards, in some ways, the purest form of tyranny, which is the idea that the authorities have the right to redefine reality itself.
Welcome to The Political Animals. I'm your host, Jonathan Cole. I'm a scholar, writer, and translator who specializes in political theology, the intersection of religion and politics. I'm really excited to welcome to the show someone whose work I'm a fan. That was very awkwardly articulated, but we'll get better as the show goes on. And that is Brendan O'Neill. I forgot to ask where he's coming to me from, somewhere in the UK, I gather. And I'm going to let Brendan introduce himself because I discovered in our pre-chat that he has, in his words, one of the most scurrilously inaccurate Wikipedia pages out there. And I do not want to misrepresent who this man is, who's a superb writer, amongst other things. Brendan, firstly, welcome to the show. And if there are any listeners unfamiliar with your work, who are you?
Hi, Jonathan. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm coming to you from London. That's where I was born, where I live, where I work. The greatest city in the world. No offense to any listeners in other fine cities. And who am I? My job is I'm the chief political writer for Spiked. Spiked is a pro-free speech, pro-enlightenment magazine, current affairs magazine, publishes 6 or 7 brilliant articles every day, podcasts, videos, all sorts of things. So anyone who hasn't looked at Spiked should look at Spiked. Prior to being the chief political writer for Spiked, I was its editor for 15 years, which was a pretty hectic job. In my view, it's the best job in the British media because on Spiked, you can really say what you want and we can publish writers who don't get published elsewhere. And it was a really fun job to have. I also write for other publications. I write for The Australian. I write for The Daily Mail here in the UK, and I'm a regular contributor to The Spectator. Some people will be familiar with my work from The Spectator. I have a podcast, don't we all? I have a weekly podcast now called...
Literally everyone listening has their own podcast.
Yeah, probably. Everyone has a podcast these days, I think that's great. Let a thousand flowers bloom. My podcast is called The Brendan O'Neill Show. It's a weekly podcast in which I chat to interesting political people, writers, philosophers. So I enjoy doing that. I was wary of having a podcast to begin with, but now I've really grown into it. And I have a new book out, which is called A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And it's a collection of 10 original long reads on some of the controversial issues of our time and why I think it's important to be more heretical, more questioning, more argumentative against some of the ideologies and orthodoxies that are being forced down our throat these days.
And I suppose, Brendan, some people will really know you above all for your work on the issue of free speech. I wonder, if I were to describe you as a free speech warrior, how would you respond to that particular moniker?
I love it. I am a free speech absolutist. And whenever I say this on radio or TV, people will always say, you're not a free speech absolutist. No one is a free speech absolutist. And I'm afraid to say I am. I don't even, I just got in a bit of hot water for writing a piece for Spiked about Ben Robert Smith in Australia, in which I not only took the side of the newspapers, because I think press freedom is very important, but I also said that defamation laws should ideally be scrapped. I don't even believe in libel laws. I think they're an incredibly authoritarian tool. I get defamed and libeled at least once a week somewhere on the internet. And, you know, if it's serious, for example, if it happens in a newspaper, you should write a letter. You should ask for an apology. You should ask for a correction. I've had to do that a couple of times. If it's not serious, you can just let it slide if it's just some idiot on social media. But I do think you should not try to shut people down. You should not try to censor them, even where they say things that are clearly incorrect. So I am a free speech absolutist. I'm a free speech warrior. In my mind, freedom of speech is the most important value in a democratic society. It is the freedom upon which every other freedom depends. So every chipping away at freedom of speech is a chipping away at the foundation stones of civilized society. And I don't think people realize how much we will lose every time we lose a little bit of freedom of speech. So it's so important to defend that value.
That's really interesting. Before we get into your book, I want to just probe a little here to explore the boundaries, which I guess by definition don't exist if you're a free speech absolutist. But I guess I would like to just put you a couple of things. Just be interested to see, the grounds on which you dismiss it. And just to put my own colours on the ground, I'm not a free speech warrior in the sense that I haven't done the kind of work you've done. But I thoroughly agree that it's at the absolute apex for me in terms of freedoms for that very reason you articulated. Although part of me wonders whether I've put it at the apex because of the particular cultural moment we're in. But even if it's just contingent on the absolute assault on free speech that I see, and I'm a writer too and a podcaster, so I feel I want as much clean air and scope and horizon as possible to do my own speech. But I wouldn't describe myself as a free speech absolutist, but I push myself to try and put the threshold as high as possible and have the most minimum exceptions. And it's really interesting to hear that you think we could scrap or should scrap the defamation and libel laws, because the kind of exception I've always had in my own mind, and you might be able to persuade me there's no need for this exception, because if we can get rid of an exception, I'm all for it. So obviously, I don't think offensive speech should be banned. I think you should be able to call anyone anything publicly. When it comes to speech that has a material effect on your ability to work in a career that you have chosen, that's where I start to wobble, I have to be honest. So for example, and I'd be interested to know if you even put this in the category of speech, if someone makes a vexatious claim against you of, say, child sexual abuse, which for obvious reasons is going to be extremely damaging because it's a horrific and abhorrent crime. But if someone does that, say, because they want to silence you or get you fired, and yes, the investigation might go nowhere and you might get exonerated, but if you're a person of profile and that makes it into the information ecosystem, that allegation will always be there. And so a case like that, I mean, firstly, do you think that's even in the free speech category, or is that a sort of totally different legal realm? Maybe vexatious complaints is something totally different. Or do you think, is your argument more that the importance of free speech and the fact that if you just put a few cracks in the dam, you can burst the dam? Do we just have to put up with some unideal situations for the sake of free speech?
Yeah, well, we do, definitely. I mean, we have to put up with a lot of unideal situations for the sake of freedom of speech. Every day, I think, we hear people speak nonsense, say horrible things, say prejudiced, bigoted, racist things, say untrue things. That's the price of freedom of speech. You know, if you go on the internet, you will find loads of people engaging in Holocaust denial, for example, or saying things about non-white communities that are repugnant to the vast majority of us. And you think, God, that's horrible. I wish it wasn't there. But that is the price of freedom of speech. It does mean that you get the bad stuff as well as all the good stuff, which is the ability of citizens to think for themselves, distribute their ideas, disseminate information, make their own judgments, and be free, autonomous beings. I think the important thing about freedom of speech, the most important word in freedom, in the phrase freedom of speech, is freedom rather than speech, which is why I think it needs to apply to everyone. And also what we have to remember, I think, is that it's just as important for the person who's listening as it is for the person who's speaking. We tend to think that freedom of speech is all about the freedom of the speaker, but it is equally about the freedom of the listener. Mm. Frederick Douglass made this point, the great slave turned abolitionist, when he said that all attacks on freedom of speech are a double wrong, because they silence someone who has something to say and they deprive the rest of us of the right to listen to him. The reason that's important is because the great thing about freedom of speech, in my view, is that it allows the ordinary person to use his moral muscles, to make moral judgments, to weigh things up, to say this is good, this is bad, this is right, this is wrong. And that is the only meaningful way in which we can be free adult citizens, if we have the ability to make those judgments. The terrible thing about censorship, the most obnoxious thing about censorship, is that it takes that right away from us and it makes decisions on our behalf. It decides for us that this thing is obscene and shouldn't be seen by other people, that this thing is deeply offensive and will hurt your feelings, that this thing is Islamophobic and will make the Muslim community feel disrespected, as if the Muslim community doesn't have the same capacity as everyone else to withstand offensive commentary and make moral judgments. So that's racial paternalism on top of censorious paternalism. Censorship turns us into children, and it says that there are other people who are better informed than us and more morally perfect than us who should make judgments for us. That's its greatest defense, and it's intolerable for me that anything should be censored on those grounds. But when you raise the possibility that there might be cases where freedom of speech doesn't apply, I mean, there are cases where speech is actually part of a crime. So, for example, I would not defend the freedom of speech of a gang of seven men who sit around their coffee, their breakfast table, planning a bank robbery, for example. That's, even though they're using words and they're saying, I'll do this and I'll bring the car at 3 p.m. And they might even email each other saying, let's do this bank, let's do that bank. That's all speech. That's all words. That's all expression. But I'm not going to defend that as freedom of speech, because they are in the process of organizing and commissioning a crime. So that's part of that crime. Likewise, there are instances, I think, you gave the example of someone being falsely accused of being a child abuser, for example. There are instances where that could cross the line into harassment. Mm. Where someone might be bombarded with this kind of accusation. Their email inbox might be full every day of the week with someone saying this and that. And that does cross a line into a form of harassment. And I have been on the receiving end of harassment campaigns, quite a bad one last year. And I did have to report it because it was it became intolerable after a while. I won't say what it involved in case it gives any of my haters ideas on what to do. But it was horrible, and it was definitely not a freedom of speech question, because it was a constant campaign of bombardment with unpleasant things designed to make me feel distress and alarm. And that gets very close to becoming a physical act of intimidation. Mm. So there are those very narrow instances where speech can be part of a criminal enterprise. But on everything else, it's interesting that you say, what if it's someone with a public profile who gets accused of something that he or she is not guilty of? Because what's interesting about that is, in the United States, where the defamation laws are far better than Australia's and England's, they err far more on the side of liberty. In the United States, it's precisely if you're a public figure or someone with a profile that you usually don't have the right to sue for defamation, because it's assumed that you have greater leeway to counter the claims, to make your own opinion. You have more platforms, you have access to media and so on. And I think that's probably the right approach. Whereas if you're an ordinary person, one of the little people, as they might say, who doesn't have those platforms, then American defamation laws gives you a bit more leeway to take action in order to protect your reputation. That's probably the right balance, I think. Definitely preferable to Australia, definitely preferable to England. Our libel laws are a pox on freedom of speech. They are a disgrace to democracy. That's why they're used by Saudi oil businessmen and Russian oligarchs. If they ever want to sue someone, they don't sue them in the country of origin. Even in the country of origin where the thing was originally published, they just say to themselves, was it published in England? And if it was, anywhere, even on the internet, they say, let's go to London, because they know our libel laws are medieval, regressive, illiberal. They favor the rich, they punish journalists, and they clamp down on freedom of speech. So we have to be careful, I think, that we don't say speech that is unfair and malicious and maligns people in an unjust way is so awful that it justifies new laws, because I think we would probably come to regret that.
I think that's a great response. It makes me mindful that when you say you're a free speech absolutist, and just in general, when we're thinking about free speech, I think this is lost sometimes in the debate. We're not talking about the scope of the freedom of speech in some vacuum. It's within the context of a legal order that criminalizes certain activity. And so it's not that you're saying remove all laws and have an anarchic society. I guess you're assuming that, you know, you can't murder and you can't harass or stalk or intimidate or threaten violence, make death threats and the like. And it's interesting, actually, Brendan, that example you gave of the criminal gang planning to hit a bank, you could actually argue that their free speech is actually preserved. Like, they are allowed to plan the event. It's just that there are going to be legal consequences if they're caught, because the crime is not the speech, or not necessarily the speech. It's the act of going into the bank with a gun and holding it up and stealing the money. The one other issue before we move on to your book, which is really interesting, and that is copyright. And again, I wonder if you would sort of separate that into the general legal architecture, because arguably, you know, someone in India reprinting your book and selling it, you know, for $2 or whatever and making money, you could say that's an act of speech. But of course, they're stealing your intellectual property. So how do you think of copyright? Or are you indeed against copyright? I imagine.
Well, I've had that exact experience that you've just described, actually, except it was China, not India. And 15 years ago, the 2008 Olympics in Beijing, I think it was 2008, I wrote a few pieces for Spiked and for The Guardian. Funnily enough, I used to write for The Guardian, which seems so strange now, about what I refer to as China bashing. I said that there was too much hostility to not the Chinese regime. I fully favor hostility to the Chinese regime. I'd like to see more of it, especially from the Chinese, especially from the Chinese people who have been rising up, especially during the lockdown period, which I think was incredibly positive. But there was too much hostility to China as a nation and sometimes to Chinese people. So I wrote these pieces saying, look, let's lay off. Let's see what the Beijing Olympics is like. Let's give them the benefit of the doubt. And let's stop speaking in borderline racial terms about Chinese people as a group. And the People's Daily, which is obviously the Communist Party paper in China, read by, you know, I don't know what it is, half a billion people or something like that, half the country, started to republish my pieces from Spiked and from The Guardian. So I dropped them an email and said, can you stop doing this? Can you acknowledge where they come from? And they just completely ignored me. They just didn't say anything whatsoever. I had the same experience in Zimbabwe during the Mugabe years. I wrote a piece. I'm an anti-imperialist. I oppose Western interference in other states' affairs. I believe in national sovereignty. So I wrote a piece criticizing the idea that there should be Western sanctions imposed on Zimbabwe. I argued that they were more likely to hurt ordinary Zimbabwean citizens than the regime itself, which would find a way around them. And it was republished in Robert Mugabe's Harare newspaper, except they did this really funny thing where every time I mentioned, they took out my paragraph saying, of course, Mugabe is an awful tyrant. They took that out. And then every other reference to Mugabe, they called him Comrade Mugabe, as if I was going around referring to Comrade Mugabe. So, and again, I emailed them saying this is wrong, and they just didn't respond. So I've had that experience, and it's very frustrating. There's little you can do globally, I think, to rectify those things. But I think on copyright, I don't particularly have a problem with copyright as such, because people have a right to ownership of their words and ideas, ownership of their novels and their plays and their pieces of journalism. There was a plague. I'll just tell one more story about myself before. I don't want to get too self-obsessed, but there was a plagiarism scandal in Ireland about 10 years ago, where there's an Irish newspaper called the Irish Examiner, which is, you know, they've got three papers there, the Irish Times, the Irish Independent, and the Irish Examiner. And a columnist for the Irish Examiner was ripping off my columns word for word and presenting them as his own for about 6 months. And then someone finally twigged and alerted me, and it was a huge scandal in Ireland. The guy was obviously sacked. He was he basically left the country in shame. It was a strange affair. And that was a case where I had to write to the newspaper and say, you can't do this. You can't falsely present my ideas as someone else's. That's an invasion of my copyright. That's an invasion of my words, and it's plagiarism, and it's wrong. So that's obviously not a freedom of speech issue. You know, if you were to publish a novel, Jonathan, and someone just republished it, another printing house published it without your permission, unacceptable, not right. Possibly copyright could be eased up here and there. Does it need to be 70 years before you can publish someone's? I think it's 70 years you have to wait. I think George Orwell has just passed that milestone, so we can now expect to see millions of copies of 1984 by every publishing house on earth. I think copyright's probably okay, but I do think in all of these discussions the erring has to be on the side of freedom of speech, and the erring has to be on the side of as much liberty as possible. So anything that encroaches on it needs to be thought about very, very seriously. Is this a justified encroachment? Is this a justified restriction? Or is this going to tamper with the right of people to express themselves in a fair and in the way that they want to? And that's got to be the question we ask ourselves all the time.
And I guess, Brendan, the other thing is just reflecting on this copyright issue, that it's not a question of whether a certain word or phrase or idea can be put into print, particularly like when we're talking about a novel. And I really don't think any novel should be banned. Personally, I can't think of a reason to ban anything, and definitely not to change after the fact the words, which is absolutely scandalous, as has happened with Roald Dahl and who knows, God knows how many other authors that we perhaps don't even know about. And the other thing is that in asserting your copyright, you're not preventing the ideas being out there. The point is they're already out there, and it's about stopping others from either monetizing your own work, which you might make your living from, but also misrepresenting the authorship. And one of the things I think I'm sure we probably agree on is that one reason why I think you want more information in the information ecosystem, including, I'll say, false information, conspiracies, and everything, because it goes to that that point of individuals need to be able to sift and sort and hear different arguments. Otherwise, we do all become unthinking automatons. You just have to read George Orwell's 1984. I'm a little worried if it becomes too accessible, Brendan, because I think some people see it as a manifesto rather than what I think is almost the most terrifying novel you could ever read. I recently reread it, and I had read it as a kid, and I was amazed at just how bleak that novel is. There's like literally no hope. It's the most terrifying. I kept reading it thinking, I enjoyed this as a kid. I'm sure there's some kind of light in here. But no, it was just felt like pure darkness. Anyway, I'm just rambling on, and we should get to your
but
book.
I was just going to say something. Yeah, no, but on that point you make about freedom of speech for misinformation, that is so important, I think. I actually think it's good that we have misinformation. I think it's good that we have speech that is clearly wrong or false. It plays an important role in society because it means that you can challenge it. It means that you can see it. You know where it's coming from. You know what it consists of. And therefore, we have greater freedom. Those of us who believe in truth and reason and enlightenment and freedom, we have greater capacity to challenge it and to confront it and to promote what we consider to be the right way of thinking or the truthful claims about a certain issue. You know, it's always worth remembering that the Vatican had a devil's advocate. I mean, the phrase devil's advocate doesn't come out of thin air. It was the Advocatus Diaboli, whose job in the Vatican was to represent Satan, essentially, and to argue against the canonization of a saint. So when the Vatican was beatifying and canonizing a saint, this devil's advocate would come in and say, no way, he's a loser. He was an evil person. He was a horrible person. They would dig up as much contrary information as they could find in order to counter the canonization. And the reason the Vatican did that was to strengthen its own arguments, was to strengthen its own claims. I'm sure it became a bit performative after a while, but it's a good reminder that seeking out false information, misinformation, wrong information, things you disagree with, can be a really useful exercise because it helps you to sharpen your own arguments and your own point of view and to make your own case. So the idea that we should suppress false information strikes me as completely wrong. Firstly, it's utterly illiberal. And secondly, it weakens our right to make the case for truth. And, you know, I always think about John Stuart Mill on Liberty, which I read at least once a year. And he makes the point that the only way in which you can ever assume that you are right about something is if you submit your opinion to the most rigorous, ruthless, free public discussion possible, because that's the only way you can test it out. If you don't do that, then you're a dogmatist. You believe something not because you've tested it and made sure it's right, but simply because you know it's true. That's religion. That's not principle. That's dogmatism, not freedom. So the more that people ensconce themselves in a safe space, like we have on university campuses, or in an echo chamber like we have in everyday life, the more that they are turning themselves, the more they are making themselves stupid and ignorant, and people who hold opinions simply because they know they're right rather than because they've tested whether they're right. So it's the safe space is such a dangerous trap, primarily for the people inside, even more so than the people they want to censor and block from coming in.
Yeah, I think people, I mean, the misinformation thing is really fascinating, that there's so much angst and focus on it. And in one respect, I get it. I mean, I do think there is false information flashing around the ecosystem, but the thing I don't understand is that that misinformation is so quickly and routinely called out and often fact-checked. And for it seems to me, anyone with even the modicum of the ability to think critically can, even on intuition and gut, can say, oh, this doesn't feel right. I need to do a bit more investigation. So it's not like the misinformation dominates and is unanswered. You got to look at it within the context, like you say, of a contest of ideas. And the other thing I don't get is that, in my view, people have a right to be wrong.
Yeah.
I don't, like, the moment you lose the right to be wrong, then you have to assume that there is some authority that is determining the right view on this or that. And then we really are in an Orwellian paradigm. And of course, the fundamental fact of human society is that we don't agree on what is right. So any system in which you lose the right to be wrong means one minority view starts to outlaw all the other minority views, because on all the things that actually matter, we humans disagree. And it's not always even binary. There are often multiple views and perspectives. And the only way, again, recognizing that freedoms come in a package, so you can't have three freedoms and not one freedom. You know, you can't have freedom of assembly, but not conscience. Like, they cancel each other out. You have to just recognize that humans need the right to articulate their different perspectives and actually trust people rather than infantilize them to make their own decisions. And I'm willing to bank on the fact that ultimately the truth will win out enough, the truth, you know, whatever the truth, that there will be enough consensus in society as people are exposed to different perspectives and different views, and you'll probably agree that I will tolerate things that I think are false because I just see that as the cost of a free society.
Yeah, I think I really agree. And the right to be wrong is such an important right to defend. And in fact, we were talking earlier about defamation law in the US. It's really worth everyone reading up on a landmark defamation case in the US in the early 1960s. It was New York Times versus Sullivan. And this was a case where a Montgomery official, I think it was a Montgomery police chief or something, he sued the New York Times because they published a whole one-page advert about Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. I think they did it in 1960. And it contained some inaccuracies. One of the inaccuracies was the number of times Martin Luther King had been arrested in Montgomery. I think they said 7 or something, but really it was only 4, you know. So these officials in the South sued the New York Times and said, you're factually incorrect, and therefore you have to retract this. And the judgment in that case was, number one, you're a public official down there in Montgomery, so you have to take the blows of public debate. You're not an ordinary person, you're a public official. But also, people have to have the right to get things wrong. They have to have the right, as part of public discussion and working things out, that, you know, sometimes they will make mistakes. Sometimes they will say 7 arrests when it was actually fewer than that. It's a really important judgment, and it's a beautifully written judgment, and it defends freedom of speech in a way that you just wish courts in Australia and England would do that sometimes. Of course, we did it historically, but we don't do it very often these days. So the right to be wrong, and the right and the importance of tolerating false information. One thing that makes me laugh about the current crusade against misinformation, and there is a crusade. You remember Biden was thinking about setting up a disinformation unit at one point, which is chillingly Orwellian. The BBC here in the UK has just launched something called BBC Verify, where it's going to look into misinformation and expose it. And there are, as you say, fact-checking organizations. But a lot of that is very political as well. A lot of that is very much designed to call out misinformation in the campaign for Brexit, for example, or misinformation in things that Donald Trump says. Whereas you can have a situation where Joe Biden refers to Dylan Mulvaney as a girl. Why is that not misinformation? It's obviously factually incorrect. Dylan Mulvaney is a young man. Kamala Harris writes a letter to Dylan Mulvaney congratulating him on 365 days of authentically being a girl. That's not being called out on BBC Verify. The BBC published a piece a while back in which it talked about pregnant men. Well, why doesn't BBC Verify look into that? So the point I'm making, I don't want to just pick on the trans issue, although it is fascinating to me. Misinformation comes in many different forms these days. And I think the current obsession with misinformation really only emerged after the populist votes of 2016, firstly for Brexit, then for Trump, the rise of populism in Europe. Populist parties have taken over in Italy, and they're doing very well in Sweden and other countries. It was only after that that people became obsessed with misinformation, because they thought voters, who they look upon as stupid idiots, had been misled by misinformation. That's why they were voting for these parties. They couldn't possibly have made a rational moral judgment that the old elites were letting them down, so they were going to take a chance on someone new. No, they had to have been brainwashed and hoodwinked by lies on the internet. So there's an elitism behind it, and also a double standard, because very often the old technocratic establishments that want to crush misinformation promote misinformation more than anybody else.
Yeah, this is the whole misguided notion that if we just give people good information, which means our information, the things we believe, then they will make better choices.
Yeah.
That underlines the whole, what I would call, progressive view of education, which is that if we enlighten people with a certain conception of enlightenment, they'll all be good citizens. But of course, underlying all this is a particular conception of what a good citizen is. And to my earlier point, all of these things are contested. So it's not like we agree on what a citizenship is, what the point of education is, how you should be voting. I mean, our entire political system in the West, in almost every, well, continental Europe's a little different because of the way they are organized, but certainly in the Anglosphere, we've all evolved into two-party systems. So the very sort of premise, if you like, of our political system is contest between competing visions of the good society, the way to run the economy, and et cetera, et cetera. But Brendan, I'm not going to let you respond to that, because I do want to get to a Heretics Manifesto, because we need to talk about cancel culture, which is a big part of this free speech issue that we're discussing. And I want to read a quote to you, not because you don't know what's in your book, but for the benefit of the listeners. And I've had the privilege of reading some of the essays, and there's some crackers in there. But you say something that really struck me in the introduction, which I hadn't encountered before, which was interesting. And that is basically you think cancel culture is too soft a term for describing the scope and scale of the problem. But just let me read out a three-line quote, because you are a great writer and I want people to get a sense of that. You say this: the phrase cancel culture just doesn't cut it. It just doesn't capture what we're up against. It's too soft, too quaint, cute almost. It's like referring to the Inquisition as information management or to Salem as accountability culture. So talk to me about you're a free speech warrior who is against cancel culture, but you actually think that the cancel culture is not doing, as a term, is not doing justice to the nature of the problem. Talk me through that.
Yeah, and that's right, and that's the opening, that's the introduction to the book. So I do think it's a key point. I should say that I am someone who uses the phrase cancel culture all the time, because it's become part of common speech. It's recognizable to people. It's used in the media. It's used in political circles. It's used by the public. So it's a useful term. I also use the word woke, and who knows what the word woke means, but I do think people instinctively know what it means. I think they instinctively know who you're talking about when you talk about the woke. They know you're talking about a pretty identitarian, judgmental, upper middle class section of society that has disdain for ordinary people and their values and their right to express themselves. So people have a general sense. So these phrases, even though they can be insufficient, they can be useful in terms of capturing something and distilling something, especially if you're having a conversation with someone. You know, if someone on the street starts complaining about cancel culture and how problematic it is, I'm not going to say, actually, I think you'll find cancel culture is not a good enough phrase. You know why? No one wants to be that person. But the reason I wanted to make that point in the book is because if we're having a broader discussion about the contemporary climate, especially in the Anglo-American world, there's definitely flashes of it in Australia too. I think France is resisting it a bit better. I've done a podcast with Robert McLeam Wilson, who's a really fascinating guy. You should have him on as well. He's an Irish writer who's a columnist for Charlie Hebdo, brilliant defender of freedom of speech and the right to blaspheme and the right to think freely. And he was making the point that there is still a willingness to withstand the onslaught of American origin political correctness in France, where you have professors saying, no, we don't want this wokeness on our campus, get the hell out of here. So but I think in the Anglo-American world it's taken hold, and the issue I have with the term cancel culture, as you say, as you quoted from the introduction, it just isn't strong enough to describe what we're up against. I mean, it's accurate in the sense that people get cancelled for saying things. That does happen quite a lot. People lose their jobs. People get no platform from universities. These things do happen. But I think it's far more serious. I have the same issue with the term political correctness. I always thought that was far too soft and mild to describe what happened in the 80s and the 90s, which I think was basically a coup by an emergent graduate elite who took over the institutions and enforced their morality on society at large. Political correctness never really captured that. And I think the same thing about the nanny state. I think the nanny state makes the contemporary state sound like Mary Poppins or something, just a bit bossy, you know, shoving the medicine down your throat, when in fact it's reorganizing the entire relationship between the citizen and the state. And I did a speech in Australia about 10 years ago on the nanny state, where I made this point that we should stop calling it the nanny state. And I quoted John Locke and his letter concerning tolerance, which was really one of the first documents of the Enlightenment, published in the late 1600s. And it's a brilliant document on the limitations of the state and the rights of people, especially their rights to religious freedom and religious belief. Brilliant document, really set the ground running for the freedoms we enjoy today. But he has this amazing piece in Letter on Tolerance where he says something like, should the state have the right to intervene if someone is making themselves unwell? And he says, no, they shouldn't, because that's too much of an encroachment. And then John Stuart Mill developed those arguments, of course, in On Liberty, where he says even saving an individual from himself is not good enough reason for the state to interfere in your life. You can only, the state should only do that to save another individual from someone. And I think that's right. So the reason I'm making these points is because all of these things that we live under today, political correctness, wokeness, the nanny state, cancel culture, they've all become slightly comedic phrases. And we talk about political correctness gone mad, you know, the schools that ban bar black sheep because it has the word black in it. Or we say, oh God, now the nanny state wants to ban extra large packets of crisps. And we all laugh about it. Or we say, oh, have you seen who's been cancelled now? You know, J.K. Rowling, one of the most esteemed authors in the world. They even want to cancel her. It's become a joke. Whereas I think, obviously, it is a joke and it's ridiculous and we should make fun of it ruthlessly. But it's also very serious because I do think it represents a corrosion of enlightenment itself. And it represents, I think it speaks to Western society's abandonment of the principles of enlightenment, especially tolerance, freedom of thought, freedom of conscience, freedom of speech, which came slightly after the Enlightenment, but was inspired by it. All those great values that make life worth living, essentially, are all being undone by this new intolerant culture that silences people, which punishes wrongthink, which even makes it a speech crime to say that women don't have penises. Mm. And one of the points I make in the book is that if you live in a society, as I do here in the UK, where a female politician in the Labour Party, whose name is Rosie Duffield, can be hounded from pillar to post, can be treated really badly by the Labour leader, Keir Starmer, can be Twitter mobbed almost every day because she once said only women have cervixes. It's not enough to call that cancel culture. We need another word to describe that. That's hysteria. That is a Salem-like hysteria where, in this case, a woman is being treated in the most appalling way for expressing a biological truth, which 6 or 7 years ago, everyone in the world would have agreed with her. So there's something about this hysterical, deranged, deeply, deeply authoritarian moment that I think is very particular, incredibly worrying, threatens to undo liberty in the most profound way. And I just think calling it cancel culture kind of lets it off the hook. And I'm not going to sit around and come up with another phrase. I'm not particularly good at coming up with phrases. And whoever came up with cancel culture is obviously far better than me. But I just think it's worth us thinking about the seriousness of the moment that we are in and how challenging it is for those of us who believe that freedom is the essential value in society.
I think the point you're making, if I may, and I think it's a point well made, an important point, is that there's something a little anodyne about the language we use to describe the, what I would say, contemporary cultural diseases risk absolute destruction, in my view, if left unchecked. And what happens is that the language allows people to become a bit accustomed to it. So yeah, there's a bit of cancel culture over there, but it's not going to affect me and it doesn't affect most people. But they don't realize that it's symptomatic of a disease that will, I think, eventually pervade all of society. Because the mere extraordinariness of that comment, the politician over on your side, of, you know, that only women have cervixes, which is an incontrovertible scientific fact and has been for millennia. Once that threshold is passed, there is no limit to what, for ideological reasons, what facts or people could outlaw or use to cancel people. And perhaps we should segue into what is just an unbelievable first essay called Her Penis. And I want to read the first paragraph, because as I was explaining to you off air. What you do brilliantly in this essay is you manage to draw out the sheer absurdity and ridiculousness of the situation, but also its seriousness. So on the one hand, you're tempted to laugh at the bizarre oxymoronic phrase, her penis. And I think there's a temptation to dismiss this kind of stuff as, you know, a few kind of crazy lefties go in for this weird stuff. But when you put in the dogmatism and the cancel culture aspect and the coercive pressure to commit really linguistic travesty is really extraordinary. But let me stop banging on and actually read the first paragraph because it really hits home. And again, for the benefit of listeners, you say, we need to talk about her penis, not about any specific individual's private parts. That would be weird. No, we need to talk about the union of those two words, the smashing together of the female pronoun and the noun for the male genital organ. Her penis. Nothing better captures the irrationalism of our age and also the slippery authoritarianism of it than the fact that this nonsensical phrase is frequently uttered and as much in the respectable press as in the gender bedlam of internet discussion forums. If anyone tries to tell you the culture war is a myth, show them her penis. And then you go on to sort of list a bunch of headlines in respectable newspapers. I'll just give one in case there's anyone under a rock who doesn't know what's actually going on. And this just shows it's not out there. This shows the mainstream. And I think it's this trans question is really the tip of the spear here in terms of the assault on free speech, because it has intruded, unlike any other issue, into the mainstream. And, you know, you say, for example, you mention a headline in Metro, and I quote, ex-soldier exposed her penis and used wheelie bin as sex toy in public. And of course, some of us have probably read the stories of women raping other women with their penis in prisons and the like.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to hand over to you now so you can get yourself cancelled rather. I've probably got reading out your words. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, how do we make sense of how on earth did we end up here? And what?
Yeah, well, that's the question, isn't it? And working out how we got here and how we get out of it is really, really important. And I think the reason I opened with that chapter, her penis, firstly, as you say, it's just funny. I mean, it just is funny that so many newspapers and really respectable people in society will say something like her penis, which is obviously a lie. It's false information. You know, talk about misinformation. I run through lots of cases in that chapter from newspapers and from contemporary discussion where people have said her penis. And of course, in every one of those situations, they were men. Of course, they were men. There was a really chilling case, actually, which is leaving aside the funny, stupid ones. There was a very chilling case where a man who identifies as a woman was put in a woman's prison here in the UK. That is happening quite frequently, and he sexually assaulted some female inmates. And in the court case, they described him, they said, she approached the women with her penis sticking out of the top of her trousers. And I just thought to myself, this is the world we live in now, where even rapists are, even the delusional identitarian fantasies of rapists are being flattered lest we cause offense to some minority group. And just think about what that does to the female victims of that man, because what it means is that in court they have to sit there and listen to this man being described as a woman. They are under pressure to refer to him as a woman. They are under pressure to say she about a man who violated them with his penis. This is really incredibly serious stuff. And the point I make in that chapter is that it demonstrates when you have a rape victim in court having to say she and her about the man who raped her, that demonstrates that political correctness, or whatever we're calling it, it now enjoys dominion not only over reason and freedom of speech, but over human decency itself. What kind of society would force a woman to do that? Only a society that had completely lost its moral bearings. So it's very serious. And the reason I wanted to open with that was just to draw out exactly what you're saying there, which is how did we get here? Because what I find most striking about phrases like her penis, or, you know, men can get pregnant, or you don't have to be a woman to have a cervix, all these things which are just completely untrue, is it really demonstrates that I think we're heading towards, in some ways, the purest form of tyranny, which is the idea that the authorities have the right to redefine reality itself, that they have the right to define what is true, what is a fact and what is a lie, and that the rest of us have to follow them. We have to discount the evidence of our own eyes. We have to doubt the light of our own reason and just accept that what they say is true is true. And if they say this man with a beard and testicles and a penis is a lesbian and should be allowed into lesbian spaces, we have to nod along. And if you don't nod along, you're a bigot, you're a TERF, you're a transphobe, you're prejudiced, and you might be cancelled. That's how serious things have got. And all of that, those things I've just described are happening. There's now a case in Australia that you'll be familiar with where a woman is trying to, a man, look at me, even I'm slipping up, a man who claims to be a lesbian wants the right to go onto lesbian dating apps. You think, no, piss off, get the hell out of here. You're a man, you're not a lesbian. It's really important to defend these things, firstly, because women deserve their own spaces in which, where they get undressed or where they need domestic violence assistance or rape therapy or whatever it might be. There are certain spaces where women deserve their own privacy and blokes should not go in. That's the first thing. But even more importantly than that, and that is pretty bloody important, even more importantly than that is we have to stand up for the right to defend reason and to define reality as it actually exists rather than as the establishment would want us to think it exists. Because if we don't do that, then all is lost. That's why the trans issue is so important. Because if we don't have the right to stand up and say, that person over there with a penis and XY chromosomes is a man, then everything falls apart. Because you're not allowed to express truth itself. And what happens in that situation is that the ideological delusions of the establishment take precedence over reality. And then our role simply becomes to either make ourselves complicit in their untruths, which means lying to ourselves and lying to everyone else, or we get cancelled. Those are our two options. You either bow down to their lies or you have yourself cancelled. And I think in response to that, we need to fight back and say, sorry, I'm not going to go along with this. I'm not going to use so-called preferred pronouns. I'm not going to lie about someone's gender. I'm going to tell the truth, because the truth is absolutely essential to civilization.
Yeah. And for me, the ultimate goal of free speech is the truth. Because I think the truth is simple or that we can reach consensus, but the mere pursuit of the truth, which should be a human goal, and it does, I think, have to be done collectively, because we need to learn from other people's experiences and bounce ideas off. Unless you are free to question literally everything, then you guarantee that you are not going to actually discover the truth. And this applies in every direction. And so obviously, you know, people often say to me as a conservative that, like, we focus too much on the trans issue. But I don't think, I'm with you that this is, for me, the trans issue is about free speech. So
yeah,
I actually can live in the world if people want to identify as the opposite sex, and if I would even support the freedom, if the person next to me wants to use certain pronouns, go for it. I just draw that line at being coerced. Mm-hmm. To play along with what I regard, like you, as an untruth, a falsehood, or not just any falsehood. This goes to the very fundamental fabric of the truth of existence.
Yeah.
And you just think about how literally Big Brother like this is. So the whole thing in the Big Brother world in your London, as it was George Orwell envisaged it, is not just that Big Brother and all his apparatchiks can decree that something's the opposite of what it is, but the truth constantly changes in this arbitrary, capricious manner. So you look at the one of the backdrops of 1984 is this sort of perpetual war between the three big continental armies. And of course, the propaganda is just constantly flipping because, Eurasia's at war with Oceania or whatever it is, and then suddenly they're at war with the other one, and they have to change all of the truth. And so as a citizen, you're in this awful world where you know the truth could be literally anything, and it could change on a dime. And the consequences of not actually, pivoting with the official narrative. And so the idea that, I watched this documentary, I think it was a Vice documentary, and I found it so chilling, to use your word, because it was about a man that gave birth to a baby out of her vagina. And the thing that really chilled me was the obstetrician, who was a female, biological female, going along with the pretense that this really was a man, and that a man was literally squeezing a baby out of his vagina. And I just thought, this is a highly educated, of the people you want to be in touch with reality, your medical professions. And it made me realize that, there's something extremely disconcerting about the possibility in 20 years of me going to the doctor, and the doctor is in some kind of delusional parallel reality because they've grown up in the Big Brother world, and they're told that all the scientific knowledge, which is essential for actually treating the body, is just irrelevant, and it's culturally determined. I'll tell you what, I'm really worried if I get cancer and have to have cancer treatment, and the doctor thinks that a man can give birth to a baby out of his vagina. I mean, it has serious repercussions.
It has very serious repercussions. And I think the case you mentioned there of the woman who gave birth to a child, but the woman identifies as a man, I think that's the same case here in the UK, where the woman who did that wanted to be identified as the baby's father on the birth certificate and went to court and everything. And the court said, no, sorry, you can't do that. And it was a great moment, I think. Because you can't have official documents that contain misinformation. There's now a situation in Ireland, in the Republic of Ireland, where trans people can have not only their passports changed so that it changes from male to female, but their birth certificates. So they can have their birth certificates altered so that instead of saying a man was born in February 1985, it will say a girl was born, which is not true. That's the falsification of historical records. And that is straight out of 1984. One of Winston Smith's jobs at the Ministry of Truth was to rewrite old documents and old newspaper articles to make them accord with the current truth and the current propaganda, and to memory hole inconvenient old articles and to replace them with fresh information, to lie. And that's happening right now. So one of the examples I give in the chapter on her penis is the case of an 83-year-old woman in New York City who murdered and decapitated a woman in her 60s. And you read this, it was in the New York Times, huge story. It was on the BBC website here. And you read it and think, hold on, this doesn't add up. Since when did 83-year-old women murder women? I mean, that's, and decapitate them. That's ever happened. It's very, very unusual. Certainly, I can't recall any case in my lifetime. And you read it and think, this makes no sense. 83-year-old women tend to be quite small, quite frail, certainly not murderous, certainly not willing or able to decapitate people. It was a man. Of course it was a man. And you only found out towards the very end of that New York Times article where it said so-and-so identifies as a transgender female. You only found out in the last line of the BBC article. So they were lying to us. The whole piece that they published in the New York Times and the BBC was full of lies. She did this. She cut her head off. She stored her head in her apartment. It was lie upon lie. And what they were doing in that situation was sacrificing the truth, sacrificing reality at the altar of ideology. That is directly out of 1984. I know 1984 is an overused reference these days. Sometimes I write for newspapers and things here and they say, can you not mention 1984 this time? Because I do refer to it a lot. But that is out of 1984. That is what happens in Orwell's dystopian nightmare world, and that's what happens in our world right now. And I think it's so important to push back against that and to insist that they tell us the truth. And again, I just would make the point that imagine what this does to the victims, you know, the victims of that man, that 80-something man in New York. It deprives them of the right to tell the truth about what happened to them, which is that they were attacked by a man. They were assaulted by a man. If they say that, if any of his victims say that, they run the risk of being called bigoted. They run the risk of not being allowed to speak at all. So that's incredibly cruel. But more importantly, if we don't defend the right to say, to describe what we see with our own eyes, that's a man, that's a woman. If you give birth, you are female. You cannot be a father. That's not possible. It's not correct. If we don't have the right to define what we see with our own eyes, to define the truth as it is exists in a measurable, tangible way in the world around us, then we lose every right. And what we end up with is the elites who are gaslighting us morning, noon, and night, trying to tell us that what we see in front of us is a lesbian, when in fact it's a man. And they are trying to drive us mad and try to push us over the edge of sanity. And it's so, so important on that issue in particular, the trans issue, which I think is at the pinnacle of all of this new authoritarianism. It's so essential that we stand up and make the case for reality.
I agree. And here's the thing, Brendan, that I find perplexing, but also curious and interesting in a sort of pessimistic sense. So I can actually understand the trans activists. They've got an ideological agenda and they're quite explicit about this. And you note some of this. It's not like it's a secret. They are aware that changing the language does change the reality, and they are trying to deconstruct gender and then reconstruct it on the new footing, because they're aware that they are against tradition, the scientific knowledge. I mean, we look as a relatively similar age. I mean, when the education system we came up was teaching us that women have cervixes and that there is a fundamental distinction between men and women, and that it's biologically determined. That there was no hint in the biology I studied at school in the 80s and 90s, primary school and high school, that like this is so for certain people of a certain age, the change is so shocking, because the world you were reared in has evaporated. So I can understand the trans activists, because I think their eyes are wide open. They understand that they have a massive task in front of them to go against people's instincts, intuitions, the reality that they see with their own eyes. If you're of a certain age, everything you've ever been taught and take for granted. The perplexing and curious, but also intellectually fascinating bit, and this is the bit that caught me by surprise, is the way so many in society just caved. That means to me there was some brittleness and weakness that I had not been aware of in society, because I constantly think in quiet moments, like when you're someone who doesn't go along with it, you're just like, why have so many people gone along with it? And one of the reasons why the trans activists are in some ways very honest, I think, is they know they have to use coercion and intimidation, because their view is actually the minority view, although they're having a lot of success. But I don't think this can all be explained by coercion and intimidation, because I see loads of enthusiastic people putting he, him, or she, her next to their name when they're very obviously a woman or a man, and there's no ambiguity or question mark there as a kind of virtue signal. And I you know, I know a lot of these people, they haven't been coerced. And it's a lot of non-trans people doing the coercion as well. So it's not like it's all just the trans community. And just one simple example, I spent 13 years working in the public service for the federal government in Canberra. But the timeline is interesting. It was 2001 to 2014. When I left in 2014, Brendan, I had never received an email from any public servant with pronouns in it. Mm. Now, when I look at my old colleagues on LinkedIn, I don't know what percentage it is, but a significant percentage now have their pronouns after their name. So I worked in four different departments and agencies. And in that period, 2001 to 2014, and I'm serious, not once had I ever seen a public servant. And that's a really tangible change that I've noticed. And I don't think there's any edict. This is a sort of cultural change that people are, you know, some people move. But again, back to the fundamental point, I'm literally in shock that we ended up in 1984 so suddenly and so easily. I thought we were a liberal democratic society. The sort of liberal order wasn't supposed to be this vulnerable, I thought, according to
I think that's right. It is quite shocking. I mean, I think I flip between thinking it's all been quite sudden, and your example of pronouns in email bios is a very good one. Who knew anything about pronouns, you know, a few years ago? Now they're absolutely everywhere. So that does feel like a sudden, kind of slightly hysterical, swirling development. And you think my view is that it's become almost like a religious movement. And the way you, just as people might have worn a crucifix in the past or said, I go to church every Sunday, now you declare your pronouns. It's a way of signifying that you're part of a select group whose awareness has been raised. You know, that's the religious feeling that they have. You know, we must raise our own awareness and raise other people's awareness.
A whole bunch of men and women that have become conscious that they're men and women.
Yeah, exactly.
Pronouns sort of just match the biology.
Yeah, that's right. It's those people who really make me laugh. I remember Joe Biden declared his pronouns, and I was thinking him, of course, and I thought, Joe, no one thinks is going to mistake you for a woman or a they, them. We know you're a bloke. So it's very odd. So that feels quite sudden. But then another part of me thinks it's been a long time coming. And I think it does go back to political correctness, that insufficient phrase in the 80s and the 90s. It goes back even further than that with, I think, you know, the 1960s, I guess. Lots of great things happened in the 1960s, but one problematic thing that happened is that the uprising for greater liberty that took place in that decade did morph quite quickly into an authoritarian movement, particularly in the 1970s. Christopher Lash describes this incredibly well in his book Culture of Narcissism, which I think should be the Bible of anyone who wants to understand the horrors of the moment that we live in. That was published in 1979. If you read it, you would think it was published yesterday. It's extraordinary about the way in which the counterculture shifted us towards narcissism, self-obsession, identity, frailty, vulnerability, an obsession with therapeutic treatment. Just great. So then another part of me thinks it's been happening for a long time, and the trans thing is just the latest and most bizarre manifestation of it. But I think you're right to say that one can understand the trans movement and why they behave in the way that they do. I think one of the reasons they do that is because I think at some level they recognize that there's a house of cards element to their claims. I do think that the reason they are arguably the most censorious movement in the Anglo-American world right now, they tolerate absolutely no criticism or dissent at all. They would really want to shut down everyone who misgenders, in quote marks, or who says that biological sex is real or that men are men and women are women. They would shut down every one of them. I think they have an instinctive recognition of the weakness of their case. And that weakness is very clear to many of us, which is that the idea that one has a gendered soul, which might not match with one's biological casing, is obviously a ridiculous, regressive, hysterical idea. And I do think that they have some instinctive recognition that it could fall apart upon the merest questioning and the merest criticism. So their censoriousness is understandable. The other mistake that the trans lobby made, of course, is that they upped the ante. They upped the ante in a really problematic way. If you go back 7 or 8 or 9 years, most people were happy for trans people to be around, of course. Most people still are happy for trans people around. Knock yourself out, do what you want to do, that's fine. you know, a man saying that his name is now Dolores or something and he wants to be she, her, most of us would have been happy with that. But the lobby upped the ante and they said, actually, we want to play in women's sports. Mm. We want to get in the boxing ring with a woman and punch her in the face. We want to play women's rugby. We want to do women's cycling. We want to go into women's changing rooms and take our clothes off in front of 8-year-old girls, right? That happened in Los Angeles in the Wii Spa controversy, where a man who identifies as a woman undressed in front of a minor. We want to go into domestic violence shelters. We want to run for a woman-only position in a political party. We want to win Women of the Year awards. There's a businessman here in the UK who identifies as male on some days and female on other days. He won a Woman in Business award. So they upped the ante. They went too far. And that's when everyone said, no, hold on. We were more than happy to indulge your identity, even though we don't think it's particularly real. But we don't want you destroying women's sports. We don't want you taking prizes away from women. We don't want you in women's private areas where they might be vulnerable or have to get undressed or need assistance. So you went too far. That's the problem there. And I think many people recognize that and are very angry about it. But as to the rest of society going along with this, I think that question you raise is just so fascinating and essential. And I do think about it a lot. I think the one way I see it is that I do think this issue in particular provides a very useful moral mission to political and cultural elites that have slightly lost their way. So these are elites that have given up, who feel very alienated from the founding principles of our societies. Then they don't, you know, Australia is now seen as a country born in colonial sin, born from racism, horrible history and rotten place. People in the, say the same about the UK all the time. They feel very, the elites feel very alienated from the traditions and the history of their own nations. They feel they've lost their sense of purpose, I think. They've lost their sense of legitimacy. They don't even have the Soviet Union, for heaven's sake. Against, at least against that, they could say, there's the evil empire, we're the good empire. They don't even have that balancing mechanism anymore as a way of boosting their sense of moral purpose. They've lost a lot. And I think what the trans issue does, and wokeness more broadly, it provides them with a sense of moral purpose. It provides them with a sense of being a mission. They are protecting the vulnerable. They are declaring their pronouns, which is a way of demonstrating your virtue. They are using it as a mechanism to control the troublesome masses. You know, it's a useful tool for censorship. It's a useful tool for interfering, as you say, in the very ideas of existence. What is a mother? What is a father? What is a family? Are they even important? It allows them into all of those zones of life as well, through this manipulation of language, through this erasure of the idea of biological sex. It gives them purpose and it gives them power. And I think that's what draws them to it, even though I'm sure some of them recognize at some level that it's a species of hysteria. Mm. So I do think wokeness across the board, and also climate change alarmism, which I think is important too. It's slightly separate, but it's important. And I write about that in the book as well. It gives them a sense that they're not just a boring technocratic class of managerialists who are running society, which is what they are, but instead they can present themselves as the valiant defenders of oppressed minorities and the saviors of the planet itself from the industrial hubris of humankind. Mm. So they embrace these hysterical claims as a means of furnishing themselves with a sense of moral mission in society. And that's why they're so devoted to these crazy claims.
I find there's a lot compelling in your depiction there of the elite class and their role in this particular perversion that we're living. One thought about the people under the elite, just the common people in all their complexity, I wonder if part of this goes back to certain cultural ideas that are now really firmly ingrained, that for me personally, looking back, are very problematic. And a lot of people know they're problematic now, but they didn't seem problematic at the time. And that's tolerance, diversity, inclusivity. And so I think one thing that may have happened is that with all these people very attuned to being inclusive, supporting diversity, and being tolerant of difference feel like they have no choice, even when they're being asked to utter unrealities. And so that just, it probably A, shows just how strong these concepts have come to the point where they override the senses and they erase the knowledges that were taught beforehand. Yeah. And you see this kind of absurdity in scientific journals and the like. And so in a way, I think concepts that everyone would say instinctively are good. Even I'll say, like, I can get on board with a certain level of diversity, inclusion. And I think I do want to live in a tolerant society. Mm. But there has to be some control under that. And you have to, in my view, you have to be able to draw a line. And the fact that a lot of people think for the sake of diversity, being inclusive and showing tolerance, they have to alter their very perception of reality, or even if it's they haven't altered their perception, they have to behave as though plus one equals three.
Yeah.
And that, whether that's the education system or who knows what, or the loss of the kind of thing that religion gives you, but I'm not trying to say that religion was perfect and it left, but religion, for all its faults, had a very definite view of certain questions, particularly in morality. And I think what I often say, I am a religious person, but what I say to non-religious people is, by all means, criticize, say, the old dominant Christian culture of Australia and the UK. That's fine. But what you replace, when it left, it wasn't replaced by another order, but by a disorder of a kind of bizarre relativism, which, if unchecked, I think can take us down this path. And then new kind of religious concepts, and maybe inclusivity and diversity and tolerance and these kind of things become in some way sacred acts. And so to not show tolerance of, you know, to not be tolerant of the way the rapist identifies, which just sounds nuts. But of course, if you follow the logic, you can, once it becomes a religious principle, and to go against it is sacrilegious and will lead to excommunication.
Yeah.
I've probably just ran lots of different ideas. I've just seamlessly gone from one theory.
There's some really good ideas in there. And I was thinking about the religious aspect of this as we were talking, because one thing that I often find myself correcting myself, because I do refer to some of these movements as religious in feeling, but I often want to correct myself and refer to them as pseudo-religious or cultish, which I think is preferable. I was brought up a Roman Catholic. I'm no longer a Roman. Oh, well, I once a Catholic, always a Catholic, I suppose. I'm a lapsed Catholic. I was brought up religiously. I was an altar boy. I went to Catholic schools from the age of 3 to 18. I was educated by nuns who were fine. One or two of them were quite severe, but they were fine. My family is religious, so I have an enormous amount of respect for religion and the role that it plays in people's lives and in communities. I've written quite a lot over the past few years about the problem of new atheism, this kind of muscular secularism, which I just find very hollow and sometimes quite hateful, and looking down its nose at religious people rather than putting forward a humanist argument. I've always thought it's so bizarre to define myself as an atheist, because you're defining yourself, even though I myself am an atheist, I would never define myself as such, because you're defining yourself as a negative. I don't believe in this. Okay, fine, big deal. What do you believe in? So it comes to the world in a negative way. So I sometimes have to correct myself and say, is this religious or not? The difference, I think, between religious values that people used to hold and we had great meaning in people's lives and the current values that are being forced down our throats, key difference is... I think one of the important differences is transcendence. And one of the great things about religion in people's lives is it provided them with a sense of transcendence. It helped them to make sense of the world in which they live, but it promised a sense of transcendence from the troubles and the strife and the tensions that they experienced. If you look at something like the climate change ideology, for example, it does mimic end of days religiosity in some ways. So, for example, we've all committed the sin of environmental degradation, and we have to pay the penance of recycling and shrinking our carbon footprint. And if we don't, there will be an end of world event in which billions will die. I mean, that has very clear echoes of a revelation style view of the world. But what it doesn't offer is any transcendence from that. So it just turns the Christian story into this incredibly bovine, animalistic view where all you have to do is live with less, shrink your footprint, don't drive your car, don't eat that hamburger, don't go on that holiday, sacrifice for nothing, literally nothing, just so you can put your hand up and say, I'm a small person with not much of an impact on the planet. You don't even get to heaven, for God's sake. It's so depressing. So there is a very important difference there. But I think another aspect of it, which I think is very important, is the it's really important to remember, I think, and I remind myself of this all the time, that the Enlightenment, which is a period I'm very interested in, comes from Christianity. It comes from, and Pope Benedict made this point very well. I wrote an obituary for Pope Benedict at the end of last year, and I made the point that he was a far more keen and fine defender of Enlightenment values and reason than his critics in the New Atheist movement, because he actually studied the Enlightenment. He admired aspects of it. He described Christianity as a religion based in reason. It was a religion based in a reasoned attempt to understand the world. And he said the problem with some of the new movements that we have today is the culture of relativism and the unwillingness to make moral judgments and to say something is good or something is bad, something is right, or something is wrong. So this brings me to your point about tolerance, because tolerance was actually a really important Enlightenment value, but it didn't mean just nodding along to every stupid idea and piece of crap that comes your way. Tolerance was an active value. What it said was, you absolutely should tolerate the existence of alternative ways of thinking and different religions, but you don't have to respect them. You don't have to bow down to them. You don't have to say they're good. And I feel that way now. If you look at something like the idea of Islamophobia, for example, and I have a chapter in my book on Islamo-censorship. I absolutely have tolerance towards Islam in my society. I absolutely support the right of people to worship the Islamic faith and to build mosques. That's freedom of religion. I have tolerance towards their religion. I don't respect it. I'm not a Muslim. I think some of it is nonsense. I think it's wrong to make women wear the burqa. I think that's regressive and medieval and misogynistic. So I'm tolerant, absolutely, probably more so than many other people. I would not support any encroachment whatsoever on a Muslim community's rights to freedom of faith. But I'm not respectful of every aspect of their way of life or their practices or their religious ideas. That's the kind of culture we need to get back to, one in which we are willing to make moral judgments. So just on your point about why this trans thing has washed over people, I think it's not so much that we've become too tolerant, it's that we've confused tolerance with relativism. We've confused supporting people's freedom to live as they want with also supporting people's freedom to criticize and make judgments. And I think it's a fear of making judgments, making moral judgments. In this case, the moral judgment would be, that's a man, not a woman. It's wrong to subject an 18-year-old girl to a double mastectomy. It's wrong to block the puberty of anyone, because puberty is a natural part of life, not a sickness. It's wrong to tell a young lesbian she might actually be a man. That's homophobic. It's reminiscent of the authoritarian measures that were taken in the past against gay people, who are often like Alan Turing, for example, in Britain, who the great computer whiz of the 1950s and 1940s, who was forced to undergo estrogen treatment for his crime of being a gay man. And he had a choice: go to prison for being homosexual, or take this estrogen, which was a form of castration. And he took the estrogen. It gave him breasts. It made his voice high-pitched. It gave him certain female in quote mark attributes, and it made him incredibly depressed. Mm. We now look upon that as a barbaric assault on a heroic individual, but also just on an individual citizen. We've put him on the £50 note here in the UK as a way of apologizing for our abhorrent treatment of him. But we now do the same thing. Mm. We now do the same thing to young men, most of whom would probably turn out to be healthy, happy, homosexual men. We give them estrogen. We give them breasts. We make their voices high-pitched, and we call it transgender rights. So the fact that society can twist around so much, and that things that were objectionable a few decades ago are rehabilitated in politically correct language, that is such a good example of the essential importance of the right to make moral judgments and the right to freely express ourselves. Because it's in the absence of those things that these ideas take hold. It's in the absence of the ability and the confidence of us to make moral judgments that things can sneak in under the radar. And it's absolutely in the absence of our freedom to criticize and our freedom to dissent that things can get stronger and become more institutionalized in schools and universities and workplaces. Without the right to make moral judgments for ourselves, and without the right to freely express ourselves, we now know what happens to society. It goes completely insane.
Brendan, on that depressing but completely empirically accurate note about the crazy world we live in, really appreciate your work. Really appreciate the conversation, and keep fighting the good fight as a free speech warrior.
Thanks a lot, Jonathan.
If you enjoyed the show, folks, be sure to give it a 5-star rating on Apple and or Spotify. Subscribe or follow. Can never get those words out properly at the end of the podcast. Thanks to my producer, Angelo Groza. And I'll catch you next time.